This is KUOW's The Record. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. In the news today, in the 3 months the I-405 express toll lanes have been open, the state has collected more than triple the money that it said it would collect. The added money is supposed to speed up the state's plans to help expand congested areas of the highway. State law requires that proceeds from the tolls be reinvested in 405. Woodinville resident Misha Noonan drives 405 every day. He thinks the new tolls have improved his commute, and he's glad to see the state try to tackle our traffic problems.
We got to build our own way out of it, whether it's innovative lanes and tolls or light rail. I hear people are upset about it. Crybabies. Like, get over it. Let's move forward. Pay for these roads.
Crybabies, huh? Not everybody agrees with that. How about you? How do you feel about the 405 tolls? How are they working? And what are you doing about it? I don't suppose you're carpooling. Give us a call at 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. Or join us on Twitter at KUOW. At the Academy Awards later this month, no actors of color will take home Oscars. We know this because none were nominated. That omission has reignited the conversation about racial equity in the movies and in the arts in general. This year, two mainstream Seattle arts groups have focused their seasons on racial equity in their productions, their artists, and they hope their audiences. KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman has the story.
Spectrum Dance Theater's Donald Byrd doesn't beat around the bush. He calls his company's current artistic season hashtag racish for a reason.
It was the idea to help break open the conversation or encourage conversations around race, especially given what has been going on in the last year.
From the outcry over African Americans in the movies to the Black Lives Matter movement, Byrd says the public eye is focused on equity right now in a way he hasn't seen since the late 1960s. Donald Byrd is acutely aware of race. He's an African American man in a contemporary dance world dominated by Caucasian artists. Byrd says most dance companies don't look beyond the status quo for talent.
Sometimes people say things like, I don't see color, or I can't find the right kind, you know, whatever, all of that stuff. But I think you have to make an effort. And I think over the time, I have made an effort to ensure that there were always dancers of color at Spectrum, in particular African-American dancers.
But Byrd's artistic season goes beyond the diversity of his dancers.
That's faster.
On a rainy winter afternoon, Byrd and his company are in their Madrona studio. They're rehearsing a dance called Jazz. It's one of several works inspired by what Byrd calls an Africanist sensibility, art that traces its roots back to African traditions. Byrd also has decided to use music by African-American composers. That choice has pushed him outside his own comfort zone.
I'll give you an example. When I first put together the list of composers, the African-American composers, there were no women on the list. And then I went like, wait a second, Donald Byrd, you are guilty of something here. Like, by omission, you are saying that there are no, number one, there are no African-American female composers that are worth including. And secondly, you didn't even think of them as being part of the mix. So that's the kind of, my thinking had to be disrupted.
Like Donald Byrd, theater artist Valerie Curtis Newton wants to disrupt the status quo.
Creating access. The ultimate goal is to open the doors.
Curtis Newton is a University of Washington drama professor and stage director. Seattle's Intimon Theater tapped her this year to co-curate its summer festival. She joins Intimon's ongoing work for racial and gender equity. The theater company has committed to hiring 50% actors of color. Curtis Newton will help forge equity in Intimon's repertoire with a festival of plays by African-American women.
I think that privileging a different lens and exposing you to a different point of view, a different view of the world, I think is maybe the most important thing in a city like this one.
In other words, a majority white city. Intimon's festival this year is likely to include work by the mid-20th century playwright Alice Childress. In 2013, Curtis Newton directed Intimon's production of a Childress play called Trouble in Mind. It's set in a theater where a white director rehearses a play about lynching and race relations. Trouble in Mind reveals how hard it is to talk about racial equity. As the play within a play progresses, the African-American cast members become increasingly angry about the script.
This ain't saying nothing. It don't make no sense. Talk about truth is anything I can believe? Well, I don't believe this.
The play got rave reviews from critics and nightly standing ovations, but the audiences who saw it were mostly white. Intamon wants to expand that audience, so this summer they hope to take their plays to neighborhoods that don't have a lot of live theater. Seattle Times theater critic Misha Burson says building new audiences is a challenge for every arts organization.
The audience for performing arts, it's no secret, is aging. And who do we replace them with? And how much is it dependent on the race and the ethnicity of the people involved in the performances? I don't know the answer to that.
Still, Burson believes both the repertoire and the artists who perform it should accurately represent American society.
It's no longer going to be America the white. And if we don't reflect that, we're kind of, you know, obscuring what this country really is.
Theater artist Valerie Curtis Newton says her goal isn't to make people see art because it's good for them, like a dose of castor oil. She thinks great art evokes the universal human experience, and that will lead to social justice.
For me, that's the point, that this diverse group of people sits in the dark, vibrates together, and then when the lights come up, they get to look at each other and figure out how they're going to be in relationship going forward.
Intamon is still raising the money it needs to produce its summer festival. Spectrum Dance Theater's hashtag racish performances start this month. I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Do women owe anything to Hillary Clinton because of her gender? This week, two icons of female accomplishment weighed in. One was Madeleine Albright.
You have to help. Hillary Clinton will always be there for you. And just remember, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other.
Let's begin with that comment. We have Jess Speer with us with the Socialist Alternative Party. Hi, Jess.
Hey, how's it going?
It's fine. Thank you. You're supporting Bernie Sanders. Is there a special place in hell for you?
I think if I've got to be put in hell for supporting a candidate that's putting forward a pro-women, pro-worker, pro-environment agenda with a message telling people that if you stand up and you fight back, you can win this agenda, then I think I'm going to be in good company.
Put some headphones on there because we're going to broaden this discussion. Also with us, Hillary Clinton supporter and Seattle writer Erica C. Barnett of the CisForCrank.com. Hi, Erica.
Hi, Bill.
What obligation do women have to elect a woman president?
Well, I think you're sort of asking the wrong question. I don't think we have an obligation to elect a woman president, and I'm not supporting Hillary solely because she's a woman. What I think the secretary's comment, which I think is an unfortunate comment, gets to, though, is that, you know, that there is a glass ceiling in this country, and the presidency is the highest and hardest glass ceiling there is. And, you know, the symbolism that of having a woman in that office is greater than just symbolism. It's like saying that Barack Obama being the first black president was just symbolism. If we elect a woman president, there's going to be a new focus on gender-based problems that aren't encompassed by Bernie Sanders' class-based analysis.
Jess, response?
But we didn't see that when Barack Obama was elected and the agenda that he fought for. You didn't see an emphasis on race issues. You saw a decimation of wealth for black working class families. And I think the question of whether a feminist should support Bernie Sanders or support Hillary Clinton should really just be predicated on fighting for the goals of feminism, which is equality for women, and I'd also add gender nonconforming people as the feminist movement creates the space to challenge gender norms. You know, equality in politics, of course, but equality in jobs and wages. And I think we have to ask ourselves what campaign advances that. You have a campaign with Bernie Sanders saying he supports a $15 minimum wage. Hillary Clinton supports $12 minimum wage. Two-thirds of low-wage workers are women. Are they going to be helped by a $15 minimum wage over a $12 minimum wage? I think absolutely. It's a no-brainer on that question.
Well, I think that looking at things entirely through a class lens, as Bernie does, really leaves aside a lot of issues that he has not brought to the forefront and that Hillary Clinton has. We are in a historic
time. Such as what?
Reproductive rights. We're in a historic time for reproductive rights in this country. We have a Supreme Court that could be, is poised to effectively overturn Roe v. Wade. Hillary Clinton has been committed to overturning the Hyde Amendment throughout her campaign. She has put gender issues front and center. And I think that this sort of rising tide lifts all boats, idea that if we raise the minimum wage, if we eliminate income inequality entirely, then that'll fix our gender and, frankly, our racial problems, is just wishful thinking.
I think that's a straw man. I don't think that's what anybody is arguing here. But I think the question of what strategy for the feminist movement is a really good one to have, because the strategy that you're putting forward, which I think is what liberal feminism is all about, is breaking the glass ceiling strategy, where you put women in high places, you break that final glass ceiling, and somehow that'll trickle down and help working class women.
I think what we've seen over the past few decades.
Okay, just a sec. Let's let Erica C. Barnett explain that. Go ahead.
Sure. What I'm saying is it's a matter of priorities. It's not somehow it'll magically trickle down. I mean, if you want to talk about magic, the idea that the United States Congress is going to adopt a universal $15 minimum wage, that's magical thinking. But I think we need someone who's a champion, not just somebody who votes the right way. I absolutely agree that Bernie Sanders has a stellar record on women's rights in terms of his voting record. It's a matter of priorities. And the fact is that I don't believe Black Lives Matter would have happened as fast and as effectively as it did if we hadn't had a black president in the White House advocating for seeing issues through a racial lens. And no, he hasn't accomplished everything he set out to accomplish. That is absolutely true. And I don't think Hillary Clinton as president will disappoint us in the same ways, because that is the job. That is part of the job. You don't get to make laws as president. And there's a lot of magical thinking in the Bernie camp that, you know, that this movement of engaged people will somehow move Congress. And that's not how the law works. And it's one reason that Bernie Sanders has not been particularly effective in Congress.
Okay. And pausing again, and we'll have more to say about this. I just want to fill listeners in on the other comment made this week by the longtime feminist, Gloria Steinem.
It's kind of not fair to measure most women by the standard of most men, because they're going to get more activist as they grow older. And when you're young, you're thinking, you know, where are the boys? The boys are with Bernie.
Sanders supporter Jess Spear, is there any truth to the idea that some young women are into Bernie Sanders for more social or more superficial reasons than older women?
No, and that's highly offensive, which is why you've seen such a backlash from young women with the hashtag not here for the boys. There's a reason why women, young women, overwhelmingly support Bernie Sanders, and it's because of his program, but also because of his message that if you stand up, you get active, you fight for what you need, that's how you can win. That the best president in the world can't do it alone. He needs a movement of millions of people in the streets. And I think this idea that it's magical thinking that we can win this program it's a bit funny to me, coming from a discussion here in Seattle where we saw the first socialist elected in 100 years 2 years ago, and all the pundits, all the media was saying, oh, this isn't going to happen, she's got a long shot. And it was the same with the $15 minimum wage. And both of those campaigns were won and fought because we put forward what working people wanted, demanded, and said the only way to win this is by standing up and fighting for what you need and building a movement. And that's how we got it done. And I think that that's what the Bernie Sanders campaign is saying. And it's not making promises it can't achieve. What it's saying is we can only do this if we all stand up together and we fight for it.
Erica C. Barnett, we're having a serious conversation here. Do you agree with Jess Spear that it's a raw deal to be knocking Sanders supporters as being less than serious?
Of course. I mean, I think that Gloria Steinem's comment was asinine.
Okay.
And
let's agree on that.
But I will say, you know, that's just as, you know, if we're going to talk about the Bernie bros, just as those mostly guys who, you know, resort to sexist attacks on Hillary Clinton supporters do not represent the bulk of Bernie Sanders supporters by any means. You know, I wouldn't say that Gloria Steinem's comments represent the bulk of feminists who are not supporting Bernie. I mean, I absolutely disavow that notion. I think millennials are, you know, and young women are more engaged than, you know, than previous generations have been.
That's what I want to get to next. Can we finish there? Because I want to step back even from the presidential election and just get a take from both of you, Jess Beer and Erica C. Barnett, both interested in women in politics in the Seattle area. What is feminism in 2016 in Seattle to you, if you can, you know, give us a nutshell, Jess Beer, and I'll give Erica the last word.
I think it's standing up and uniting with people across movements and saying this is what we need for an equal world. I think the feminist movement is about winning equality for women and, like I said, gender nonconforming people as well. And it's equality in all the spheres, politics, but also jobs, wages, education. And what advances that? You know, the idea that we can just elect a few people and that will advance things for us, again, has seen the erosion of women's rights over the past 40 years. We have to reject that strategy because it's not working and instead move towards a working class feminist strategy that you see embodied in Shama Sawant, our Socialist City Council member.
Erica C. Barnett, what is Seattle feminism in 2016 to you? Do you disagree anywhere?
I don't exactly disagree. I would say, though, that I think feminism, you know, right now for me is seeing the intersections between economic issues and women's, what have traditionally been considered women's issues, like the right to an abortion, like the right to paid family leave, like, you know, like all the things that, like the right to a higher minimum wage, but seeing them as an intersectional issue and not as an issue that's just subsumed under this idea that if we raise income equality, it will raise all boats and that gender-specific issues do not exist. So I think it's for me right now, it's recognizing both of those issues exist and that they intersect and both are important.
Erica C. Barnett of the CisForCrank.com and Jess Speer with the Socialist Alternative Party. Thank you to both of you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
KUOW's The Record. It is 12:23. What about Republican feminists in the Seattle area? Tomorrow you'll hear what feminist and Republican Marilyn McKenna has to say about what this election means for women. And finally, members from the Russian feminist punk group Pussy Riot were in Seattle last night performing at the Neptune. The band stages guerrilla performances in public places, and they've become champions of feminism, LGBT rights, and anti-Putin sentiment in Russia. Band member Ksenia Zhivago doesn't think American women should feel obligated to vote for Hillary Clinton, that saying that's not a blow to discrimination.
It's not anti-discrimination, it's anti-discrimination, because you're asking to vote for someone just because of his or her gender, which is not right completely.
On the other hand, fellow band member Maria Alekhina says feminists are not supporting Clinton just because she is a woman. And if I can get that tape to play, you'll hear it too. Here you go.
Because if we will accept this logic, they will, you know, promote Sarah Palin because she is also a woman. So I think Hillary is, I mean, she's a good candidate, but not only because she's a woman.
Zhivago and Alekhina agreed on one thing. Donald Trump reminds them of their president, Vladimir Putin.
If you want, like, another Putin, you can vote to Trump. And my opinion, that is not the best idea. It just, like, sounds like a joke, but it's not a joke. So just don't do it.
Thoughts on the presidential election from Russian feminist punk group Pussy Riot, which performed in Seattle last night. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. There's a new novel out about a historic moment in Seattle. Here's KUOW's Ross Reynolds to tell you about it.
November 1999, Seattle is hosting the World Trade Organization meeting of world leaders, including Bill Clinton. Well-organized opponents of international trade agreements shut it down and clash with police.
The smell of the noxious gas is in the air. It's burning my eyes. I think you just heard that. That was a grenade thrown, just an audio grenade by the police at about 6 and 10.
Knut Berger has written that what became known as the Battle of Seattle was the whiff of tear gas sniffed round the world. It kicked off a series of major demonstrations at World Trade conferences. That's the context of Sunil Yapa's first novel called Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist. He calls it a fictional account of non-fictional events. Through the chaos, he follows the demonstrators, police officers, the Seattle police chief. Sunil Yapa grew up a biracial Sri Lankan in central Pennsylvania. He was in college in 1999.
When it happened, it was one of the really important moments of my life. In 99, I was in college at Penn State, and I had grown up very aware of these issues. My dad is a professor of geography, economic geography. And I was very aware of these issues, and to see a protest or to see 50,000 people publicly speaking out against, I guess you would call it anti-corporate globalization or the way that globalization was happening, really touched me because I felt the same way. I felt very strongly the same way. And it was a moment where I guess I felt less alone in those beliefs. And so it was a really powerful moment for me in my life.
Sunil Yapa remembers hearing that people around the country were organizing to protest the World Trade Organization meetings in Seattle back in 1999. Yapa thought about coming, but he'd already spent one scary night in jail in his home state of Pennsylvania for pot possession, and he was afraid of getting arrested again.
Looking back on it, I wish I had, because the people that went to jail were one of the things I discovered in the research is that people were very prepared. They were very trained. So very few people showed up on the streets without any training or preparation for what they were going to have to do. So in some ways, I would have loved to do nonviolent training about how to go into jails. And I actually, that is something that I ended up doing in college. I went into the federal prisons in Pennsylvania and would do nonviolent conflict resolution with the prisoners. It became one of the really important moments in my life. And looking back on it, I thought, oh, I could have done that in Seattle.
Even though Sunil Yapa didn't come to Seattle to be part of the WTO protests, he spent a long time researching what happened here.
There's a lot of famous photos from the protests, obviously. And one of them is of a police officer firing a tear gas canister from about 3 feet away at seated demonstrators. And I looked at that and I thought, there certainly must be a human story behind that. Of course, you feel outraged and you feel shocked. But I also thought that's probably going to be the worst moment in that man's life, looking back on it.
The cop or the person he's getting shot at?
Well, probably both of them. It's a pretty bad moment. But yeah, the cop, because it was a decision that he made or she made to do that. And so I was very interested in the book in ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances and the good and bad decisions that we make.
Sunil Yapa's novel begins and ends on the first day of the WTO back in 1999, but he sees lasting legacies from those marches.
One is clearly that here we sit 17 years later talking about it. So it had resonated in the culture, I think, despite being overwhelmed by 9/11 shortly after and the Iraq War protests. But I also think I spent some time with the protesters in Occupy Wall Street. And I think that the techniques, I wouldn't say they started in Seattle, but were used in Seattle. And particularly I'm thinking about consensus as a decision-making process and the idea that there's not going to be any top-down leadership in this movement. We're okay not saying that we have this and this demands and this message, but we're going to make decisions with a horizontal decision-making process, and everyone has to agree. And that's a very developed and complicated process.
And Seattle amplified that technique.
Absolutely,
that style of working together.
Yes, absolutely. And it's something that you couldn't help but recognize the power of and how different it was from other types of decision making when I was spending time in Zuccotti Park with some of the Occupy protesters.
And how about the issue of world trade? I mean, the battle was between those who saw world trade as a way to lift all boats and those in the labor movement and environmental movement and others who said, no, a lot of people are getting left behind when we break down trade barriers and make it easier to trade. We're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership today,
of course,
which will be the biggest trade agreement ever. There's no focus for people to demonstrate against it, but a lot of concern about it. Where are we now on that issue, do you think, since Seattle?
Well, I think the WTO really did take a blow from Seattle, and they had a lot of difficulty in their rounds that followed that, trying to get deals done. Partly because I think it emboldened a lot of the ministers from less developed nations, a lot of African ministers and ministers from Asian countries and Latin American countries were emboldened to really make bigger demands. But I think we're still in a very similar situation. I mean, TPP is very similar in the sense that it's a form of globalization where money can cross borders with absolute ease, corporations can cross borders with incredible ease, and the barriers to people crossing borders get more and more difficult. And to me, that's the wrong form of globalization.
Speaking with KUOW's Ross Reynolds there, that's author Sunil Yapa. His novel is set during the first day of WTO demonstrations in Seattle, 17 years ago. The book is called Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist. Maybe that's your next book. Maybe it doesn't sound like your speed. I'll tell you what, if you're not sure what to read next, we can help because we have Book Lust author Nancy Pearl and KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman staffing the KUOW Book Lovers Hotline.
This is Paul Krausman, Clinton, Washington.
In Clinton, Washington, what do you do there?
Well, I just recently retired from the University of Montana. I was a professor of wildlife ecology.
And so now you have some time for reading?
Well, well, I've always made time for reading. That's not a problem.
So, Paul, what book have you read recently that you really loved?
The one I really liked is The Bone Tree by Greg Ills. It's part of a trilogy. It's the second part of a trilogy, but each one of them pretty much stands alone, and I like it for several reasons. One, it's really rich in history during the Civil Rights Movement, and it is a pretty exciting book. I'm sure you've read books where you just don't want to turn that last page. And that's pretty much how this book was.
So it sounds like a book that you just were part of, that you lost yourself in. Am I right?
Well, I did in part because my background is I was raised in North Africa until I came back to go to college and really had not spent a whole lot of time in the United States. So when I first came here, I started off in Texas and wound up going to Ohio. And then from there went to the Southwest and really loved it. And then got a PhD up in the University of Idaho, and then went cruising on over to Auburn, back down to the South for my first job. And I had lived all over the world, but had never, ever really experienced discrimination like I saw down there. It was a real eye-opener. You know, I'd heard about it, of course. You know, I was in high school during the Civil Rights Movement, but it just was something that it seemed like it was still going on in that part of the world. And so the things that they're describing to me in that book, you know, just kind of took me right back to that time and a lot of the situations that were going on and what I saw and from what I've seen since then are still going on.
Nancy, hearing all this, what might you recommend he try next?
So Natchez Burning and the Bone Tree is part of actually a larger series of five books. So,
oh, five? I thought
yeah.
there were only three.
Oh, no, I believe there's five. So you might want to take a look at those. And if we were shelving Greg Isles' books in the bookstore or a library, they would be with thrillers and mysteries, as Paul said. It's interesting because when Paul started talking about it, he started talking about it as, you know, a book that you don't want to turn over that last page. But my experience with reading Natchez Burning, especially, was that I couldn't stop turning the pages, you know. Didn't you have that experience?
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then when it gets to the last page, you go, no.
Right. No, I thought it was just a trilogy. So I was glad that third book hasn't been published yet, though, has it?
No,
not
yet.
I think it's coming out later this year in 2017. So
you can look forward to that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, Paul, here's a couple of other authors and books that I think that you might enjoy for much the same reasons. There's two books by a Southern writer, a North Carolinian named Michael Malone. And the two books are Time's Witness and Uncivil Seasons, which are both set in a small town in North Carolina. And they're both mysteries. And, you know, the race relations part is not as obvious as it is in the Greg Isles books.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's not a total center of the plot, but it's always there, which I think it always has to be in books set in the South.
Right.
You know, personally, I love those books and I reread them. And they both feature the same two policemen in this small town. And another series that I really think that you would enjoy is two books by a woman named Attica Locke, L-O-C-K-E. And the first one is Black Water Rising, and the second one is Pleasantville. Again, Southern, you know, the sort of remnants of the large plantations and the way life is like for, in this case, Black men and women.
Uh-huh.
So Attica Locke, definitely. Attica Locke, actually, just to give a little context for her as an author, she writes for the TV show Empire. So she has pretty good... a pretty good thing. And the last one is not set in the South, but it's about race and it's about Detroit. And it's called The Turner House.
This is a book that's on my list,
yes.
Paul.
It's a wonderful, wonderful novel, a first novel by a woman named Angela Flournoy.
Good deal.
Yeah.
Well, so, Paul, it sounds like we've given you enough to tide you over until Greg Iles publishes the third book in the series that you like, right?
Indeed, indeed. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Paul.
Bye.
Bye.
He loved The Bone Tree. There's more Greg Iles to come in his life. And you heard about authors Michael Malone and Attica Locke and Angela Flournoy. And maybe we inspired you. Maybe you're not there yet. Do you want a good book to read and you're still not sure where to go? Maybe your tastes are completely different from Paul's. We can help you. 206-221-3663 and let us patch you through to Nancy Pearl. Tell us about the last book you loved and why. That's important. 206-221-3663. Nancy Pearl is standing by. I'm Bill Radke. Good afternoon. You're going to have to root for the Seahawks without Marshawn Lynch. On Sunday, during the Super Bowl, he tweeted a peace sign along with a photo of some cleats hanging from a wire, which I guess means he's retiring. The Seahawks said goodbye to him on their website. We'll tweet that out right now. We'll tweet Marshawn's tweet at KUOW. Mike Pesca, host of the Gist podcast. How do you rate that farewell?
I, for a second, thought he was saying I can't play football because I can't reach my cleats. They're on this wire.
They're
but
stuck
then it dawned on me.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's cool, and it's in keeping with Lynch, who is a man of few words, at least when required to have words, who spoke with those cleats and with his powerful runs. And, you know, flair, love of Skittles, beast mode. I can understand. I mean, he's a great running back to be a fan of. He gave his all in a game that demands it.
Marshawn Lynch, as you say, refused to answer reporters' dumb questions except to avert financial penalty.
Hey, I'm just here so I won't get fined.
Did Marshawn Lynch start a trend of anti-dumb question activism?
Oh, yes, but he refused to answer good questions. He refused to answer all questions. I think it was a defense mechanism. I think that they were having a great year at the time when he really embraced the laconic nature, and it worked for him. Plus, he had voluble teammates. You know, Richard Sherman certainly will speak enough for 10 people combined. He had plenty of players on offense who would talk, so he wanted to be the guy who didn't talk. It was very hard as a reporter to ever try to crack that nut, but I would watch some YouTube videos that John Moffitt posted, and he was a former lineman who also retired early, and he would be clowning around in the locker room. And there you saw Lynch's personality. You saw it when he controlled the message, like a lot of players, his personality shined through, and he seemed to be a level-headed, funny guy.
So you asked him good questions.
I was asking him great questions.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, cutbacks again. I was getting real technical. I thought that would be a way. But no,
right. Everybody was looking for the way. What's the thing I got to say to Marshawn Lynch that he's going to stop everything? Look me and say, now that's a question.
Exactly.
What does losing him mean for the Seahawks?
Well, Seattle is a team where their offense runs more and is prefaced on the ground game now, premised on the ground game. Now, their quarterback, Russell Wilson, he is an excellent runner, too, and he also uses his feet to free himself up to throw. It's not going to be as easy as some NFL teams where you could just plug a running back in there, but Lynch was mostly injured and did not play last year, and Seattle still had a good ground attack. So, you know, Lynch played for Buffalo for a number 4 years, I think, before he came to Seattle. It wasn't that great. He was good. He had good seasons, but it was being in Seattle where he flourished. So this tells me something that people who know the NFL will always tell you, that it's very much a team sport, and that's a cliche. But oftentimes, players that we think of great are very much a function of the offense that they play in, and Lynch benefited from the Seahawks offense.
Not Hall of Fame, right?
I think not. I mean, you know, Sean Alexander, another great Seahawk running back, has almost identical numbers and in some ways preferable to Lynch. It's just that Lynch played or had 1,000-yard seasons five times, and that's great, and he was a four-time Pro Bowler. But up, knocking on the door of the Hall of Fame, and he does have favorable stats to some players, if you just look at stats, better than, say, Larry Zonka. And maybe the thing that keeps him out of the Hall of Fame is that Pete Carroll didn't give him the ball on the goal line, because with two Super Bowls, I think he has a stronger resume.
Dismissing my childhood hero, Larry Zonka, this is Mike Pesca, host of the Gist podcast from Slate. Last question. Seahawks fans are taking this hard, Mike. We have actually what seems like a pretty great young guy in the wings, runs like a tank, but we're taking it hard. I guess I'm asking, how many points will we win next year's Super Bowl by?
Well, it depends if Pete Carroll decides to throw on the one-yard line. The Seahawks had a great year. They rebounded from a poor start, and I think they gave up home field advantage. So if they could get the home field, and if they have teams like Carolina coming up to Seattle, one of the hardest places to play, as I don't have to tell you, yeah, I could see them being one of the Super Bowl favorites. And I just want to give Larry Zonka credit for great facial hair.
Yes, and many, many broken noses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And stoicism thereupon. Mike Pesca, host of the Gist podcast from Slate, dispensing hope for the Seahawks along with his just likability. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thanks. I like to think of myself as a Mr. Inside to your Mr. Outside.
Together we got him. Well, that's Mike Pesca on KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You know, we're live tweeting at KUOW. And I want to thank Jason Pagano for producing the show. Join us on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. I'm just about that action. I'm just about that action, boss. Beast mode. I'm just about that action, boss. I'm just about that action. I'm just about that action, boss. You ready to go get it? You just about that action, boss. I'm just about that action.